The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
The more important than that, it's Friday. So the weekend is, well, for me, about an hour away. I gotta say, I'm so happy that this week is ending. Because this, I was trying to figure the best way to describe this week. And I had a little, an argument with myself over the word epic. And wondering what the adverb for epic is. Is it epically or epically? And the jury's still out. I think it's epically, pronounced epically. An epically awful week. Really, think about it. It began, under the heading of what should have been a good thing, the end to the war in Afghanistan, but unfortunately the deaths of 13 servicemen and women cast a horrible pall over it. We're not going to rehash the ending of the war and how Joe Biden ended it, because we did that enough. We did that last week and the beginning of this week. But it ended with that as the backdrop. It began with that as the backdrop. Early Monday morning, a Hurricane Ida makes landfall in New Orleans on the 16th anniversary of Katrina. So that happened, or was that Tuesday? The days are all getting mushed together. But, this all happened this week. So it hits New Orleans, an area that had already been devastated. Louisiana, Mississippi, all in there. It's already saturated. They've been hit by storms. And this was just adding insult to injury. So that happened. Then the Supreme Court does its nonsense by standing down and not saying anything about one of the most horrific draconian laws to go into effect, overturning 50 years of precedent. Basically they overturn Roe v. Wade using the shadow docket, a case that they don't hear, that there are no briefs on. There's no friends of the court comments. There's no arguments. When they finally did, they were asked, I guess, to rule on it or something. So the next day, they handed down a written decision. The majority decision was unsigned and it was all of one paragraph. The four dissenters each wrote their own dissent, some of them going as long as 8 pages. The effects of this are just horrific, and while we're digesting that and going through it, including the regurgitation part, Hurricane Ida's remnants come down so hard on the Northeast that the death toll now stands at around 46. 46 people over 6 states, but the most of the damage, New York City, which is not meant for hurricanes or this kind of torrential downpour. And yet, they had a record rainfall last week. When we came on the air, this way, again, the days all get mixed together, but they just had that big alleged homecoming concert in Central Park that got cut off in midstream because of the remnants of Hurricane Henri. And that broke all rainfall records in Central Park, registering, 1.94 inches in 1 hour. That was just a week ago. And then Ida comes through, shatters that record, over 3 inches in Central Park in 1 hour. The images, and I lived, I was born in New York, and I lived in Forest Hills, in Queens, when I was very little. We moved to Bayside in Queens, lived there till I was 11. 50 years ago, my family moved down to Florida. All those areas got hit hard. I'm seeing Flushing as a kid. Flushing is the town next door to Bayside, and I always envisioned a giant toilet bowl that people would go up and flush because I was a kid. Flushing got hit hard. Somebody was found dead there. Forest Hills, again, where my grandparents lived, where I lived when I was just born, got killed. Yeah, people in basement apartments drowned. They drowned. And I think back to after college, I moved back to New York, and I lived, my first apartment back in New York was a basement apartment in Brooklyn. That would have flooded. I could have drowned, because that's how most of the people who died, died, either in their basement apartments or in their cars. That just, a flash flood came in and carried them away, and people died. This was a horrific week. And then, you know, and then we get hit with the double whammy of the Texas decision, because we get the decisions, or we get the opinions, such as they were. And now, you know, we have all the cretins, the Republican governors who are trying to out cretin themselves. Kristi Noem of South Dakota, and of course our very own moron death sentence, who say, "Oh yeah, we're gonna study that. We're gonna put that same law into effect as soon as possible." Wow, and the fact that the Supreme Court let this law go through—I mean, it wasn't even just a draconian anti-abortion law, outlawing, criminalizing abortion after six weeks before most women even know they're pregnant, but basically deputizing all of the Karens out there, every busybody, nosy person who sticks their nose in everyone else's business, the same people who are screaming, "My body, my choice," because we want them to wear a mask or get a vaccine to help protect everybody else. They think now they are not only allowed to, but encouraged to file lawsuits, nuisance suits, against anyone they think might be going to get an abortion. And not only the woman who needs to get an abortion, but anybody who might help her, from a counselor at a doctor's office, from a mental health counselor who says, there are a lot of different things you can consider. You do not have to carry this fetus to term. Somebody tells a pregnant woman that, you can sue that person for $10,000, and they have to travel to where you are to go to court. And if they happen to win, they don't get their expenses reimbursed. It's just so, I mean, draconian doesn't go far enough. This is the kind of law that I would, in past years, have said, Supreme Court will strike that down. That's unconstitutional. But it's the Supreme Court who let it go through. Nothing makes sense anymore. So moving right along, we're thinking, okay, so poor Joe Biden, I actually feel sorry for him, because there's so much shit being thrown at him at once. But hey, this is the job he signed up for. All right. So, now we get, he's dealing with the hurricanes. He went to Louisiana today. As far as I can tell, he didn't throw out a single roll of paper towels and say, I give our administration an A+ for the way we're handling this. Ugh. But you know what? Maybe he should do a little more of that, because the low information citizenry of this country, the Trumpers, as it were, they buy it. You know, Trump can tell them, we get an A+ for the way we handled this hurricane, when he deserved no such thing. But, you know, you say something often enough and people take it as fact. They believe it. So, you know, I walk a tightrope. I don't know if I should encourage the president to use a bit of that braggadocious stuff that the former guy did. It's not his style. See, I don't do that either. I don't pat myself on the back publicly. I don't tout, not that this show is doing, you know, gangbusters, but, you know, there's something to be said for humility. I think Biden has it. Trump doesn't know the meaning of the word. And yet it's the self congratulatory stuff that people repeat. I know I keep calling opposite world. It is. Everything is. And then I got to go here. So yesterday, I got to say it. I vehemently disagree with Howie Klein. Now, I adore Howie Klein. He's a dear friend. We've known each other for 20, 25 years. Again, Howie and I met in a different life. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. I was doing music radio in LA, like really good music radio. Boy, do I long for those days. And Howie was the president of Reprise Records. Reprise Records, a division of Warner Brothers. When I met him, he had been, you know, run 415 Records and then Sire Records and then was promoted and eventually became president of Reprise. And my station, when I first met Howie, was this KSCA. FM 101.9 in LA, and it was adventurous, and it was the cool station. It was the station that music lovers would listen to, and so Howie listened, and that's how I knew him. Fast forward years later, Warner Brothers merges with Time Warner AOL merger thing. Howie, smart man, takes the early buyout and leaves. And goes into progressive politics. I took a little longer roundabout way of getting here, and then here I am, and then we reconnected again. And he has been doing a weekly segment on my show, I want to say for more than 10 years now. I'm guessing going back to the Air America days. I think he was on with me back in the Air America days. And so he's been going on with me the whole time. And I have no illusions that we're going to agree about everything. Howie is very progressive. I mean, very progressive. And I'm very progressive. But we have different sensibilities. Now, he lives in California, a state that's always going to vote blue in terms of the big elections, the presidential elections. I now live in Florida, you know, which was a purple state and is now... more on death sentence, and his colleagues are trying to turn it bright red, and they're doing a pretty damn good job of it. But here's our main point of departure, where we disagree, or I should start where we agree. We agree. Primary season is when you reach for the stars. This is what I love about what Howie does with the Blue America Pack. They identify and in some cases help convince people to run who would make great candidates, who could conceivably win and be real progressives. And they help support, raise money for the best of the progressive candidates out there. In primary season, and again, I'm mostly talking about a presidential race, but this applies to Senate races and to House races and even local races. In the primaries, that's when you reach for the stars. That's when you follow your heart. You go for the best possible person for the job. You know, for me, the policies, and I go after the policies. I don't vote on personality. I don't vote on appearance. I don't vote on identity. Identity politics will be the death of us. But Bernie Sanders, his ideas spoke to me and obviously spoke to a lot of very young people because he ginned up excitement on the left. He got people involved in the system who had no use for politics, would not have participated if not for Bernie Sanders being in the running. When the primary ends, that's when, you know, for me, depression takes over, because invariably, I'm pulling a number out of thin air here, but 8 or 9 times out of 10, unfortunately in this country, my chosen candidate doesn't win. It's the so-called centrists, and I don't believe there are anymore these days, but the moderates. They're not moderates. It's the party establishment who controls it. It's the machine. They call the shots, and most of the time they win. Every once in a while, we get surprised. We get an AOC beating a Joe Crowley, right? We get, we get a Jamal Bowman beating an Elliot Engel. Every once in a while, we get somebody great. We get somebody with energy. We get, and more, we're getting these really good, new, young members bringing fresh new ideas into Congress. And that's a good thing. But I decided that when it comes to a general election, if my preferred candidate didn't make it, didn't become the nominee, I don't take my toys and go home. I don't hold my breath until my face turns blue. Occasionally, I pull out the industrial strength nose clips, but I vote for the least worst candidate on the ballot. Because that's what you have to do. The primary season, you shoot for the stars. You go for the best. You go for whoever you think matches your sensibilities, will do the things that you think are needed to take this country in the direction we need to go. Once the primaries are over and we enter the general election, well, then all bets are off. Then, I hate to say it, it's us against them. And we know who they are. And we have to make sure they don't take any more power than they have. And hopefully we take some of it away from them. So, you know, when Howie says in a presidential election, and he's done this for a few presidential elections, he says, I will not vote for the lesser of two evils anymore. I get it. And you know what? He's in California, and I sort of give it to him. I tell anybody who lives in a reliably blue state, you know what? You vote your conscience. You do what you need to do. I'm in Florida. I don't have that luxury. I could not lodge a protest vote in 2016 against Hillary Clinton or in 2020 against Joe Biden. Not that I wanted to, because in both cases, it was more important to me to vote against Donald Trump. Howie in California said, you know what? I don't have to do that. California is going to go for the Democrat. I can cast a protest vote. And I don't really see a problem with that, because it's not going to make a difference one way or the other. But here's the rub, as they say. Here's where it gets to me. Here's what has been weighing on my mind so heavily since yesterday. This recall election of Gavin Newsom is not a regular election. This is another tactic of the Republican Party to steal a seat held by a Democrat and force a Republican into that seat. This is not a time when there's supposed to be an election. This recall is manufactured. I don't care if you love or hate Gavin Newsom. Election day for the governor of California is November 8th, 2022. They can't wait another year. We waited for 4 years for Donald Trump to get the fuck out of there. They can wait another year. And if you really hate Gavin Newsom, you vote against him in the general election. But I don't understand somebody who cares about the country and the future of the nation who would say, I don't like Newsom. He's a corporate shill. You know, he sucks. So I'm going to help the Republican steal this governor's seat in the largest state in the nation, by the way, where one of the senators is, 89 years old, is not all there, could keel over at any time now. And the governor, if a senator should die or become otherwise incapacitated during their term, the governor gets to name their successor to fill out the rest of the term. We don't have one spare seat in the Senate. To even tempt fate in the slightest, I think, is irresponsible and wrong. And believe me, I heard you guys. I saw the comments in the chat rooms. I got a lot of emails. I saw the tweets. I heard it. And I've spoken to friends and colleagues about it. And frankly, we're all a little dumbfounded. I appreciate Howie's dedication and his principles, but I think they're misplaced right here. And so I'm struggling. Howie's been a regular on the show for a decade. And some of the comments in the chat room aren't helpful. He's not secretly jealous of Gavin's good looks. That's not it. That's not it. He has high standards, and he does not like Gavin Newsom. I knew he didn't like Gavin Newsom before the election. But sometimes you got to take out the industrial strength nose clips and vote for the least worst person on the ballot. And he would say, if I said that to him, I did. I voted for the Green candidate. Well, no, because this was not a regular election. This is a bullshit Republican scam to throw out the sitting governor. They did it a couple of decades ago with Gray Davis, and we got Arnold Schwarzenegger. Luckily, he could have been a lot worse than he was. And Larry Elder is a lot worse than Arnold. So here's where we are. I'm grappling. I don't know. I see a call from the Southern California area is here. Hi, who's this from the 805? Hello? Caller? All right. I guess our caller must have hung up from the 805 area code. Oh, well, I was going to take the call. But so this is where we are. I'm conflicted. And you're welcome. I'd love to hear from you. 954-889-6410 is the number. Just so you know, John Nichols is our guest today. We'll be talking with John Nichols, the national correspondent for The Nation, about all of this. All of this. I've got him for a half hour. I'm going to talk fast because I've got a long list of things to cover. And actually, the thing that we're supposed to talk about is his piece in the September 6th issue of The Nation. The headline is Bernie Sanders' third campaign as chair of the Senate Budget Committee. Sanders' big government message has found its moment. And it's about, as chair of the Senate Budget Committee, Bernie, a lot of what he would have put into effect if he were to have become president, is in these two bills that are, hopefully working their way through Congress. Except, guess who's, come to ruin the party again? And I use party, in both ways. Joe Manchin. So let's recalibrate this. The biggest, this storm, Ida, they're not calling it a 100-year storm, a 100-year storm. They're calling it a 500-year storm. It was so devastating. And what it shows is our infrastructure is not capable of holding up, standing up to this kind of abuse. All right? Things are going to have to change. Cities on the water are going to have to become more flexible, where tides can come in and go out, where at high tide, if there's a king tide, oh my God, it's not going to take down an entire city block. This is all infrastructure. Everything needs to be fortified and rebuilt and re-engineered because we are in a new era in climate. And Joe Manchin's response is, oh my God, there's a lot going on. We need to put the brakes on. We need to hit the pause button on this $3.5 trillion deal that would help put America back to work, get money in the system to deal with some of the disasters we're seeing that are not going to go away. This will not end with Ida. There's another storm out there, Larry, that's already threatening. They're going to keep coming. This is only September 3rd. Hurricane season runs till November 30th. And Joe Manchin is saying, well, we need to put the brakes on. So he does that. And then AOC says, well, nice so-called bipartisan corporate written infrastructure bill you got there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to that. this whole thing could fall apart. And frankly, I wouldn't fault the progressives if they pulled their support from the first part of the deal, because the idiots like Manchin and Sinema won't be team players on the other part of the bill. I fear we're past the point of no return. And then the stuff with Texas, you know, I'm here in Florida and we got the idiot DeSantis saying, yeah, we're going to pass a bill just like that. Well, you know what? Today in Florida, once again, hit a new high for new COVID infections and deaths in the state of Florida. And yet he still won't, you know, he still, even though the courts ruled against him, he is holding back pay from the first two counties in Florida who defied his order against mask mandates. Where I live, Broward County and Alachua County, which is up Gainesville area. Those were the first two who said, you know what? Screw you, DeSantis. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. You're not a doctor. You're not a scientist. You seem to not care if our children get sick, but we want to protect them. So we're going to say when school starts, everybody wears a mask. And so what he said is, I'm going to dock those school board members of their pay. Well, a court just last week ruled, sorry, death sentence, you're wrong here. You can't do that. And he's going ahead and doing it anyway, because he's Donald Trump's protege. In fact, he wants to follow in Donald Trump's footsteps. Now, he's not going to, because now we learn, oh, you love this one, that Donald Trump is running. He's going to do it. And so the other day, Lauren Windsor was on the show. You know, she's the woman who got the hidden video of Ron Johnson, you know, the senator from Wisconsin. Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, got him on tape. Oh, that's the wrong video. Got him on tape, admitting that Joe Biden, of course, won the election in Wisconsin by a lot, because he didn't know he was being filmed, and he certainly thought she was one of them. Well, now she got a new video. You ready for this one? Oh, this is lovely. This is Jim Jordan. Oh, yeah, none other than Jim Jordan. And there's Lauren Windsor again with somebody filming. This, I'm going to play a video for you. It's fast, so it'll repeat twice. It comes from different angles. Okay, you ready? Here we go. This is Jim Jordan speaking.
Big fans, everything you do.
Thank you. He's going to run again.
He's going to run again. I know so. I talked to him yesterday.
He's about ready to announce.
He's about ready to announce. Oh, after all this craziness in Afghanistan.
He said he's really bad. Really bad.
Okay, so now they're going to come from the other angle.
Yeah.
All right, so here it is again from the other angle.
He's going to run again.
You think so?
I know so.
Okay.
I talked to him yesterday. He's about ready to announce after all this craziness in Afghanistan.
Thank God. Pardon my French.
All right, it's hard to hear, but you get the gist. So there is on tape Jim Jordan saying, I spoke to him yesterday. He's ready to announce. Of course, Jim Jordan spokesperson, when Lauren Windsor said to the press last night, I have Jim Jordan on tape saying Trump is running. He spoke to him. He told him in person. He told him himself. Jim Jordan's spokesperson did what they do. She lied. And then just a few hours ago, Lauren Windsor dropped that video. She's on fire. So now what they're saying is Trump is about to go to Iowa and the circus starts again. Actually, it never stopped. I'm exhausted. I don't know that I can take this anymore. This is insane. It's insane. It's 2021 and we're debating vaccines. We're debating abortion. I have to look at the calendar all the time. We went through this when I was a young kid. And now my daughter is going to have to go through it. It just makes no sense at all. So with that as the backdrop, let's get John Nichols on the line, shall we? John Nichols, again, the national correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's got a story in the new, the September 6th and 13th issue of The Nation that is called Bernie Sanders' Third Campaign. And it deals with Bernie's job as the chair of the Senate Budget Committee. And I'm waiting for John Nichols to pick up the phone. And how he's going around the country, really campaigning. John.
Thanks for calling.
Uh-oh.
You've reached my mobile. You can leave a message here.
Live radio. I'll tell you what. You know what? Let me play for you. Oh, I know what I want to play for you. Rachel Maddow played a really fascinating piece of audio last night. She went back, knowing the news that we're dealing with, she went back through the NBC Nightly News archives and went to January 22nd, 1973, and found the newscast that night, the night that the Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade decision. And here's what happened. Here's how it went. So I'll play this while I try to get a hold of John Nichols, because obviously I can't talk and chew gum at the same time. All right, here you go.
We have just received a bulletin from the Associated Press from Texas that reports that former President Lyndon Johnson is dead. Lyndon Johnson has died. According to the bulletin, former President Lyndon Johnson, he was 64 years old, has died, according to his press secretary. The report only says that Johnson was stricken at his ranch in Texas. He died this afternoon at Brooke General Hospital. Repeating that bulletin that has just arrived, former President Lyndon Johnson is dead of a heart attack at the age of 64. We'll have more details in the program as we get them. The other major story today, aside from the death of Lyndon Johnson, the tragic death, and the hopes for peace in Vietnam, is the decision of the United States Supreme Court. It handed down a historic decision about abortion. The court said in a 7-2 decision that in the first 3 months of pregnancy, only the woman and her physician may decide whether she may have an abortion. In the second 3 months, all the state may do is regulate abortion procedures. And only in the final 3 months of pregnancy can the state forbid abortion. The court ruled in cases from Texas and Georgia, but all 50 states are effective, whatever their laws. New York State has a liberal law, but that hasn't ended the bitter fight over legal abortions. And Betty Rollin reports on the New York reaction to today's ruling.
New York's liberal abortion law was passed more than 2 years ago, and more than 400,000 abortions have been successfully performed. Nevertheless, opposition has been bitter and continual. The law was actually repealed last year, but Governor Nelson Rockefeller vetoed the repeal. With yet another attempt at repeal underway, today's decision came as a shock to both anti- and pro-abortionist forces.
Well, it means that January 22, 1973 will stand out as one of the great days for freedom and free choice. This allows a woman free choice as whether or not to remain pregnant. This is extraordinary.
For some women, this law will mean the difference between having an abortion or not. For many others, the law will mean simply having the abortion in their own state instead of traveling to another state like New York. This New York clinic, for example, reports that 48% of its patients are from out of the state. The attitude of the Roman Catholic Church in New York was expressed by Terence Cardinal Cook in a statement read by a spokesman.
How many millions of children, prior to their birth, will never live to see the light of day because of the shocking action of the majority of the United States Supreme Court today? Whatever their legal rationale, seven men have made a tragic utilitarian judgment regarding who shall live and who shall die. In spite of this horrifying decision, the American people must rededicate themselves to the protection of the sacredness of all human life.
From the beginning, pro-abortionist forces have seen this issue as a question of freedom of an individual's choice. The freedom to have an abortion is now legal in every state. The basic legal fight is in effect over. But according to the Roman Catholic Church, the moral fight will never end, and the church will continue to instruct women and institutions not to take advantage of this choice. Betty Rollin, NBC News, New York.
Wow, so that was the news report from the night that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Roe v. Wade and said abortion is legal for women in their first trimester, no restrictions. And for almost 50 years, that's the law we've lived under until now. Until now. Okay, we were able to get John Nichols on the phone, so let's connect with him. I'm glad I got you, even just for a few minutes. So, John Nichols, the reason that I had invited you on the show is because of this great piece you have in the new issue of the Nation magazine about Bernie's third campaign, as you title it.
Yes.
Right? But then this turned into the week from hell. Oh, my God.
It did.
Right? And so, you know, in the limited time we have together, I'm not sure where to go. I guess we should talk about Bernie because this is still, you know, the success of the Nation going forward really depends on getting this package through that Bernie Sanders is shepherding. This is his baby. This is his project. And we have, you know, Joe Manchin now saying, oh, after this week, we saw that our infrastructure can't stand the climate change that's happening. So now we should just pause everything and not do anything and wait and see what happens.
Well, Manchin's message is exactly the wrong one. This week, like, frankly, the last year and a half, has been a confirmation of the need for a very, very different approach than the one that's been taken by the austerity-minded Republicans and some Democrats, which is to say, oh, well, we can't really afford to do the things that we need to do, so we just won't do them.
Right.
Now we've got a much, much greater recognition of what we have to do. And I think we can pull the week from hell together in some ways with some of the stuff we're talking about going forward as regards the budget plan that Bernie Sanders has been advancing. And that is that what we need now more than ever is clarity. We need a sense of what the problems are and how to respond to them and to get out of the sort of, you know, gray area of so-called bipartisan politics and compromises and the way that D.C. works. The way that D.C. works hasn't worked. It's failed. It failed miserably again and again and again. Bernie Sanders is arguing, with the support of Joe Biden, and frankly with the support of Chuck Schumer and some other folks,
right,
that there has to be a pivot. And that pivot has to take us to a place where, yes, we invest a lot more in infrastructure, but also we invest real money in addressing the climate crisis, doing things like creating a climate core that will... It's not the Green New Deal. It's not all that we should have, but it begins some of that concept with creating good paying jobs with good benefits for young people, mostly young people, who will then go into work that addresses the climate crisis. And it's essential. It borrows from the New Deal era, and it's a part of the budget plan. Also a part of the budget plan is a family and medical leave, which, as you well understand, is going to be more needed now than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, just what we're watching in places like New Orleans, but also in Philadelphia and in New York and out on the West Coast, where you have real crises occur, people have to be able to take time off from their jobs, and they have to be able to do so with pay and with benefits. It also includes an expansion of caregiving. And caregiving is obviously essential no matter what for our elderly, for people with disabilities. And we know that that's needed from a human standpoint. We should also understand that it's needed from an economic standpoint, from a societal standpoint. If people have to care for their parents or for a disabled loved one, they can't go to work. They can't begin to, you know, do all the other things they'd like to do, that they want to do, that they're capable of doing, because they have genuine demands, human demands on them that make that impossible. If we expand caregiving, and if we pay caregivers a living wage, and if we make sure that they have the benefits and the respect that they need, and remember, caregivers are overwhelmingly women and overwhelmingly people of color.
Mm-hmm.
We can achieve two major goals. One, provide humane care. Two, free up people to, you know, go and do more to participate economically in the society. And then there's an additional benefit, which is that by spending more resources for caregiving and really getting the money into it that we need to via the Medicaid program, we can have a huge amount of uplift for people who have historically been paid less than their fair share, who have been disenfranchised. So it's a big deal there. And then the final thing I'll just emphasize that's in this, in the budget plan, there's so much in it, and it's why Sanders has gone out around the country to advocate for it. The final thing that's in it is an expansion of Medicaid to cover hearing, dental, and vision.
Yes.
And that's a huge, huge deal for people who rely on Medicare.
Sure.
Which is a huge portion of our society. So this is a budget plan that has practical, immediate responses to the needs and the challenges we face. It also makes our lives better. And so that's why Sanders has focused in so intensely on it. And he went out last week, just last weekend, a week ago today, to Indiana, to a Republican county and a Republican district. And more than 2,000 people showed up.
Of course they did.
And cheered for the plan, right?
Yep.
Then he went out to Iowa, to a district that's represented by a Republican in Congress. Again, huge crowd cheering for the plan. He went up to Michigan, I believe it was the Detroit area, much more Democratic area. Again, huge turnout, huge enthusiasm. The reason I emphasize this sort of politics of it is that while our media is so focused on, you know, kind of the inside games of Washington and legitimately focused on the challenges of Afghanistan, you know, the crisis now on the Gulf Coast, the crisis on the East Coast, all these other issues, Sanders is providing a reminder that the American people are able to think of two things at once.
Yeah.
They can care about what's going on in the world, but they can also know that there are fundamental steps that should be taken to expand, to build the social safety net.
Without a doubt. And I'm glad Bernie's not letting up. And, you know, he's just being Bernie Sanders. This is who he is. This is what he does. This is what he's done for the 15, 20 years I've been covering him. It hasn't been 20 years yet. But this is what he does. And he takes the job seriously. And he got people excited. You know, what we're looking at right now is, I think, our whole the future of our Democratic Republic, you know, cracking. He's still pushing ahead with, let's make things better for the average person out there, the person who hasn't been gotten a bone thrown to them in a long, long time, to the expense of, you know, the wealthiest among us who get everything, and while we wind up paying the big tax bills. But now we're sidetracked with all these things, with Afghanistan, which I applaud Joe Biden for getting us out of. But the media, I think the corporate mainstream media seems to be trying to prove a point that they can be hard on Biden like they were on Trump. I don't get it.
Well, I know your point is extremely well taken. Let's, if we've got a moment, let's
yeah,
take these
we're
two sides
running a little
of
over
the coin.
Okay.
What's that?
We're gonna run over the top of the hour. So okay.
Oh, so let me, there's two sides to this coin that are really, really important. You talk about Bernie Sanders, you know, kind of staying out there and campaigning and you know, kind of keeping on message.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually very important in a time like this,
yeah,
because if indeed, as you suggest, and I think you're exactly right, that we have a struggle for democracy. This isn't just a struggle for, you know, one side of an issue or another side. This is really a struggle for democracy. One of the essential things is to show that government can work. Now, we are experiencing a week in which a lot of our media, and frankly, a lot of practical realities are suggesting where government struggles to work, right? In a disaster moment, in a very challenging end of a war moment. It's hard. I mean, that, we have to acknowledge that. That's, mm-hmm, not, that's just reality.
Yes.
And the more that we can show government can work, that it can deliver big things and make people's lives better, the more that democracy itself is sustained. Now, Republicans, our Republican friends, will do everything they can to make it harder to vote. They will do everything they can to suggest that government isn't the answer, and do all these other things that create challenges. What Sanders is trying to do is create the counterbalance to that, mm-hmm. and to say, no, you know, the fact is that if you vote for a certain government, if you elect Joe Biden and Democrats to be in charge of the House and Senate, you're actually going to get something. It's going to make your life better. And you can't underestimate how powerful that is in, you know, kind of offsetting the Trump message that, you know, only he can solve any problem, or frankly, that, you know, government isn't the answer, which is very much the Republican mm-hmm. message. So that's side of the coin, a really important side. The other side of the coin, and that's your reference there to the media coverage and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, one thing about Sanders that's important is he's always understood that you can never count on the media. You know, maybe you can count on Nicole Sandler, right? You know, and there's a
and
few
John
other
Nichols,
folks
yes.
out there yeah. who are going to do it. You know, and look, you do. You work very, very hard to tell a full story
to
open up a real discussion, which is often, it seems like it's on the margins of the debate. Mm-hmm. In fact, you're in the center of the debate. You're at the heart of where it should be. The problem is that our major media in this country is so skewed, so off message, so, you know, easily distracted. It's like the dog with the squirrel, right? You know, mm-hmm. it's like, whoa, off to the next thing.
Yep.
That good journalism isn't often understood. It isn't often recognized for what it is. And Sanders has always recognized that. And so what he knows is that at a time when our media will often be, you know, running a line 24/7, it's the talking point of the moment, that it's incredibly vital to go out and create a counter message to say, yeah, I know you want to talk about that. That's great. Glad to reference it. Glad to, you know, make note of it. But there's something else going on here. We have massive inequality in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We have a climate crisis that is unaddressed. We have 400 years of systemic racism that has not been sufficiently addressed. We have, we've had a pandemic. It is ongoing, especially in your state of Florida. And we've had the economic turbulence that plays out from that. Those realities can't be neglected, mm-hmm. even as we pay attention to other issues. And so I think that's part of why so many people have so much faith in Bernie Sanders, is they know that at the end of the day, he will come back to those core issues. He'll come back to the touchstones. And not many political figures are good at that, frankly.
Right.
Most of them, they follow the media, right? The media wants to talk about this. Okay, I'll talk about that. When Sanders goes on, he says, you know, actually, I'd like to talk about something else.
You know? Right. Yes, and he does. I've heard him do that.
The last thing I'll
The last thing you heard. Go ahead.
Well, there's just one last thing I'll throw in the mix as regards to Afghanistan. Look, our media did a horrible job of covering the war in Afghanistan from day one,
mm-hmm.
Back in 2001. And I remember, and you and I have both been at this for a while. I remember in my first story coming off September 11th, 2001, when I was in Washington, D.C., and then I was in New York. I saw all the crisis, and I wrote about some of the immediate things. But my first story for the magazine was an interview with Barbara Lee about why she voted against a blank check to the Bush-Cheney administration. And you know, Barbara Lee should have been on the front page of every paper back in 2001.
Yep.
Not because, not the exclusion of everything else that was going on. You tell the whole story. Of course you tell about the attack and the tragedy and the losses, but you also have to have a policy component. You have to look at, you know, what are we going to do and how are we going to do the right response? And we didn't do that. Our media did not do that. And so as a result, 20 years of failed coverage of a U.S. war and an occupation in many senses that just didn't work. And so now it gets done and they're like, oh, this didn't turn out like we were told it was going to turn out. Well, Isn't that, it's exactly how we were told it was going to turn out. There were people in 2001 who said, this isn't going to work. The problem is that our media didn't listen to him then. And amazingly, our media, by and large, still isn't listening. And so they see, you know, only the crisis, only the tragedy. And I think we should recognize crisis and tragedy. But what we should also recognize, to Joe Biden's credit, he stuck with the realistic plan to end the war.
That's right.
And he got more than 100,000 people out.
Which is amazing.
Epic number.
It really is. And he's not getting the credit he deserves for that. And look, war is ugly. People die. Innocent people get killed. That's what war is. That's why we needed to get out of that war, because it had gone on for two decades and took up. Look, they're screaming we can't afford things to, you know, fix our infrastructure here. Well, look at all the trillions of dollars we spent over there. For what? There's never a problem. Can we afford this war? There's only a question of, well, we can't afford it if it's to help people here at home. So our priorities are screwed up. But, you know, what got me over the coverage of this is, and I'll point a finger right at MSNBC, and Nicole Wallace, who's up there holier than thou, bringing on the people that she was in the administration that got us into this war, and she's pushing blame on the Biden administration for the way it ended. You know, stand up and you know, take some responsibility here.
Exactly. And you know, it's jaw-dropping to me that many of these networks, including CNN, you know, they've given Liz Cheney front row seat, you know, to critique the Biden administration. And she does throw some critiques of Trump in as well. And they think, oh, well, that's perfect.
Oh, that makes it fair.
A Republican member criticizing a Democrat and a Republican, how could it be better? Well, the one person she isn't criticizing is Liz Cheney.
Right.
And Liz Cheney was in the State Department and dealing with that part of the world at the time that the war was ramping up. And her father, of course, was in fact, you know, an architect of the war.
Hello.
And I know. I mean, it's like if I had Liz Cheney sitting, you know, for an interview on live television, and I was the host, I would, of course, be polite to her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think you have to be rude to people.
No.
But I think I would bluntly ask her, how dare you, you know, like go on and on about Joe Biden and even go on and on about Donald Trump and not talk about the roots of this disaster.
Exactly.
Right? Not talk about what happened. And, you know, again, I always emphasize, it's not just her father. A lot of people say, oh, well, you know, she's Dick Cheney's daughter, blah, blah, blah. No, no, no. She was there. She was taking a paycheck at that time.
Hmm.
And she had very direct responsibilities in that part of the world. And she got it wrong. She got it desperately, deeply, fundamentally wrong.
Right.
And to give her a platform now to critique the people, and especially Joe Biden, who actually got it right. I just think it's unsettling. It's disappointing. You're right to point the finger. And frankly, it reminds us that we're in a time which is actually in some ways the most dangerous of times. When you have a president like Trump in office, who's so bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who is so, you know, jaw-droppingly awful. You know, every guest on every show, except on Fox, you know, is going to critique him, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Even the Republicans who come on MSNBC or CNN, very, very critical, and appropriately so, right? That's easy. It's much more complex when you have a Democratic administration that will sometimes get things right and sometimes get things wrong. And you need nuance. You need to have, you know, some depth there and some perspective. The fact is that Biden hasn't done everything right. There's plenty of things to critique.
Oh, yeah.
But on Afghanistan,
right?
He's done a lot right.
Yes.
It's not perfect.
No.
Not perfect, but boy, yeah.
Yeah, he got us out of there. The war that I thought would never end, he We're out. Yes, there are some people, and he said we will get them out. He's working to do it, but my God, the pile on is just nauseating after a while. And as the Republicans are with their pious attitudes, I'm just so over it. The hypocrisy is stunning. But John Nichols, as we keep going, you know, I'm glad Bernie's on the road and he's pushing these programs, but we still have a problem with the party that, you know, in many ways, this is one of the things I like about the Democratic Party, that they don't march in lockstep, that people do think for themselves. They don't read the talking points that they've been handed, so you have everybody saying the same words on every television show out there. However, when you have a Joe Manchin and a Kyrsten Sinema threatening to derail the entire agenda, the entire plan to make things better for the working people of this country, I've got a real problem with that. And for Joe Manchin to stand up yesterday and say, we got to put a pause on this, what the hell?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And it is fascinating, this notion of, you know, it's like, why now?
Yeah,
why on
right.
this particular day to step up? I mean, I would venture to say, I bet you couldn't find a single person in West Virginia, you know, aside from a Republican partisan who's, you know, actively trying to, you know, defeat Joe Biden and whatever, and probably trying to defeat even Joe Manchin, who would say, let's put a pause on this. I don't think they're there. I don't think that's a part of our reality, that people are saying, no, we don't need at this point to have government trying to solve a lot of our problems. In fact, quite the opposite. Look, we just got a jobs report today. Now,
yeah.
Manchin couldn't have anticipated that, although maybe if he spent a little more time in West Virginia, a little less time screwing things up in Washington, he might have known. But you know, we just got a jobs report that shows that hiring wasn't particularly robust. Why? Because the pandemic is back.
That's right.
And it is causing real challenges, not just in Florida, and not just in Texas and a couple other states, but it's all over the country. And its impact is severe. It's very, very problematic because I have a lot of friends in the entertainment industry. They don't know whether to, you know, book a show or whether to do things by Zoom. I mean, we actually, bizarrely enough, had a certain clarity last year,
mm-hmm.
right? As bad as we knew what we could and couldn't do. Now it's sort of on the line, and restaurant owners, bar owners, all kinds of folks, and frankly, people who have small businesses, et cetera, it's just not clear. And they don't know if in a month we're going to be at a peak nationally again, which is going to screw everything up. And so as a result, instead of putting pause on, this is exactly the time when government ought to be stepping up.
Exactly.
And it ought to be stepping up. Yeah. I don't have to explain it beyond that. You know.
Right.
But government ought to be getting in there in a major way. And it's a two-pronged reality. Yes, government needs to respond to the immediate crises, the mess in Louisiana, the mess that we've got on the East Coast, which is being way undercovered up in Pennsylvania. It's not be covered in Pennsylvania, up in New York, but in through New Jersey. This is serious stuff. And it's going to require money. It's going to require resources. But at the same time, you know, the reason I would put it this way. When Republicans were in charge, as bad as they were, they at least tended to respond to immediate crises,
mm-hmm.
right? Not well, not the way I'd want them to, but they voted for, you know, rescue plans and mm-hmm. you know, pandemic plans. But the reason I think that we elect Democrats, right, or why, you know, supposedly the theory of having Democrats in there is that they will respond to the immediate crisis and they will have the broader perspective to know how to respond to the roots of that crisis. That's what's supposed to make Democrats better. That's
right.
What's supposed to make them different. And if Joe Manchin is going to come along and say, oh, no, we can't be that, well, then I'll ask you, how is he different from a Republican?
You know,
I mean, where is the difference?
I don't know. And it's funny. I played a clip that from Rachel Maddow's show that she aired last night from 1973, the day the Supreme Court handed down the ruling on Roe v. Wade. Well, it just so happens that that story got pushed back from the lead story because the news broke during the newscast that President Johnson had died, Lyndon Johnson. First of all, that he was only 64 blows my mind because I thought he was much older than that. So that's something that I learned.
We all felt that.
Right? But on top of that, Johnson would have done something. Johnson would have gone to Joe Manchin and said, look, buddy, you're going to play ball with us, and here's how it's going to happen. We're going to make you do it. You want a bridge? You got it. But if you don't play ball, you don't get no bridge. I mean, whatever it needed to take, he would get it done. And that type of work doesn't seem to be happening anymore.
No, you just nailed it. That's exactly right. You know, and I've talked about this a little bit in a number of interviews recently. You know, people are always like, oh, why can't the Democrats be as together as they were under FDR? Why can't they be as together as they were under, you know, Lyndon Johnson, where they actually got big things, Social Security, jobs programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, the war on poverty, creating national public radio, national public television. You know, I mean, you just could have to run down the list of the things they did. It's kind of endless.
Yeah.
Rural electrification, you know, going back to FDR, you go through all this stuff. You say, well, why can't Democrats do that? I guess Democrats were just more united then. No, they were not more united then. The Democratic Party was more divided then than it is now.
Wow.
Then they had a segregationist wing from the South that was horrific.
Right.
And that was at odds with, you know, all sorts of important stuff. They had the Democratic Party in FDR's era stretched from literally social Democrats, Marxists, all the way over to, you know, scorching reactionary segregationists. I mean, it was a very, very big party. And you say, well, how did FDR do that? Well, they made people do things, right? Mm-hmm. They used pressure. FDR, as president of the United States, supported challengers to sitting Democratic senators in primaries.
Go figure.
Lyndon Johnson. Oh, my gosh. I mean, people, there's stories of you know, very strong, very powerful U.S. senators who dreaded going into Lyndon Johnson's office.
That's right.
Because they knew when they went in there, they were not going to come out until they had agreed to work with him on whatever issue he needed to do. And of course, he destroyed himself with the madness of the Vietnam War.
Yep.
There's no question of that.
Yep.
That was Johnson's great failure.
Yep.
But on the domestic side, I mean, again, look at that record. Ending the poll tax of the Constitutional Amendment, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, war on poverty, the developing out of National Endowment for the Humanities, developing out of public TV, public radio, the, you know, creation of consumer protections that, you know, linger to this day, the underpinnings of environmental protections, major environmental protections that exist to this day. Nixon actually codified some of them, but it started under Johnson.
Right.
Planning for the future of work. Johnson's administration was a remarkable administration on the domestic level. And, you know, he didn't have a Democratic Party that was easy to work with. He made it work. And that is why, supposedly, we elected Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Because Joe Biden's 36 years in the Senate, 8 years as vice president. He's supposed to know how to do this. And so, theoretically, Joe Biden ought to know how to deal with Joe Manchin. And I understand that Biden and Schumer have thought to give Manchin time, right? You know, to help him adjust to this reality. But I'll tell you, when they come back after Labor Day, when the Senate returns, they better adjust in a great big way, and very quickly,
right?
Because they have some things right away. Number one, they have got to get rid of the filibuster.
Yes,
and
if they don't do that, nothing else happens. Nothing else happens. If they don't get rid of the filibuster, nothing else happens. Everything else dies.
They may be able to get reconciliation on the budget. They might. Bernie Sanders might be able to get that. But if you cannot get rid of the filibuster, right, you cannot get
voting rights,
the People Act. You cannot get the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. That's critical for democracy itself. Yep. You cannot codify women's rights and Roe v. Wade. You cannot get the PRO Act, which allows organized labor to go out and do the job that it needs to do to organize workers and collectively bargain. You cannot get the policing reforms that we were promised last summer and into the fall and that are absolutely essential as a part of a broader racial justice and social justice agenda. You just keep running down the list of the things we can't get unless we get rid of the filibuster. And now, if Manchin undermines reconciliation, then you can't get anything.
That's right.
Right? And then it's nothing. And I'll tell you what, you know what that adds up to? I can spell it out very, very simply. That's Jimmy Carter. And I love Jimmy Carter. He's a great man, fabulous ex-president. But you know what happened to Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, everything.
He lost the presidency.
Exactly. He lost the presidency and everything collapsed around him. And what's worse is today, you know, I saw you posted Lauren Windsor's video of Ron Johnson admitting that, you know, Biden won Wisconsin. Well, today she has a video of Jim Jordan admitting that Donald Trump told him just yesterday that he is indeed running and he's headed to Iowa. Oh, please. I can't take this anymore.
Yeah, but Trump is running. There's no doubt of that.
Right.
And that's maybe the best news.
Right. You're right. I think you're right.
He's the one guy that, you know, Biden beat Trump once.
Yep.
And Biden will beat Trump again if Biden's running in 2024. I'm pretty sure of. My great fear is, my fear is of Trump running. I'm not going to try and be, you know, glib about this.
Right.
I think he's an incredibly divisive and dangerous figure. But my fear has always been of the next Trump, right? The
Ron DeSantis.
Suit, better tie.
Oh, God.
A little bit more calculating, a little bit more careful in how he or she says things, Republican, who does the Trump agenda, but does it with, you know, better framing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Better branding.
Right.
And so whether we get Trump as a candidate in 2024 or whether we get Trump version 2.0, 2024 is going to be a blisteringly difficult election.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Biden or Kamala Harris or whoever the Democratic nominee is can win in 2024, but they can only win if the Democrats do the right thing in 2021.
Yes.
Not 2022.
Yes.
Not 2023.
Right now.
2021. Right now.
Right now. You're so right. John Nichols, I hope everybody listens to you. I hope, you know, the people on Capitol Hill listen to you. I hope Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, she scares me a lot, too. I don't trust her for a minute. But this is all hinging on them. And they could sabotage us. I don't want to think that way. We, you know, please, spirit of LBJ, come down and, you know, haunt the Oval Office for a while. And get some of that energy in there and make this stuff happen, because otherwise we're done. And I hate saying
it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we're done, but we're in the midst of a fight that we don't want to be in.
Right.
I mean, it's just, look, it's bad enough now, right? It's hard enough right now. I don't want to have my daughter and, you know, her friends come into a world as difficult as it could be.
Yeah.
And so, no, I'm not, you know, I don't know how scared I am one way or the other, but I'm concerned. You know, I'm worried about the moment that we're in. I'm worried about the circumstance that we find ourselves in. And frankly, I want us to get a few things right. And it's possible. It is not hard to get things right. But to do that, to get on the right side of things as a society, we have to have a two-party system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And when one party wins, it has to govern. It has to do the things that are necessary.
Right.
And that's not happening.
No.
That is not happening right now. I do not blame all Democrats. Some Democrats are trying really hard. But the fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, I tell you this, in November 2022, if Democrats think they're going to be able to run around and say, oh, well, you know, we tried really hard.
Yeah. No.
But it just didn't work.
We had the presidency, we had the Senate, we had the House, but we just couldn't deliver.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's how you lose.
Nicole. Yep.
John Nichols, I'm losing you. You're just cut out. But I thank you so much. I'm glad we connected. I appreciate you calling in and staying late with us. Have a wonderful Labor Day, and I'll keep my fingers crossed that people are listening and good will happen.
My fingers are crossed for you, Nicole. Be strong. Carry on. I hope to talk to you again very soon.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much, John. You take care.
Take Bye-bye. Care.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Bye. All right. With that, we're done. Thanks for hanging out in overtime with us. Thanks to John Nichols for coming through. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody. It is the Labor Day weekend. Again, Monday there will be a show, but it's going to be audio only. So no YouTube Monday. You can listen at NicoleSandler.com/listen-live, NicoleSandlerStream.com, or at ProgressiveVoices.com. Or any of the other stations that carry us. Thanks for hanging. Thanks for being here. I guess I'll leave you with the news because we can. All right. I'll see you back here, well, for the Music Monday, live on back on YouTube Tuesday.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The death toll in the Northeast from the remnants of Hurricane Ida now stands at 46 people dead in 6 states. Most of them were in New Jersey, where Governor Phil Murphy said a majority of the victims were overtaken by rising floodwaters while in their cars. In New York City, a lot of people who died were found in basements. Meanwhile, communities in Louisiana, where the hurricane made landfall, still have no power and are struggling with a severe fuel shortage. President Biden visiting Louisiana Friday to survey storm damage and meet with state and local officials. I think it's fair to say he will not be throwing out a single roll of paper towels to people in need of help. Responding to the radical, unconstitutional action of the Trump-packed Supreme Court, President Joe Biden says he's launching a federal effort to respond to the new Texas abortion law. The state's abortion providers are turning patients away following the new law that took effect at midnight on September 1st. It bans abortions after 6 weeks or as soon as a fetal heartbeat is heard. The Supreme Court denied a request from abortion providers to freeze the state law, so it remains on the books for now. So this law features a vigilante enforcement structure. It basically deputizes private citizens to bring civil lawsuits against anyone who might assist a pregnant person seeking an abortion. Biden called it a bizarre scheme with the potential to unleash, quote, unconstitutional chaos. So he tasked the Department of Health and Human Services, along with the Justice Department, to see what steps the federal government can take to see how the administration could respond to the decision and protect existing constitutional abortion rights. The landmark Roe v. Wade decision was handed down January 22, 1973, and established the right to abortion until fetal viability at 22 to 24 weeks.
The other major story today, aside from the death of Lyndon Johnson, the tragic death and the hopes for peace in Vietnam, is the decision of the United States Supreme Court. It handed down a historic decision about abortion. The court said in a 7-2 decision that in the first 3 months of pregnancy, only the woman and her physician may decide whether she may have an abortion. In the second 3 months, all the state may do is regulate abortion procedures. And only in the final 3 months of pregnancy can the state forbid abortion. The court ruled in cases from Texas and Georgia, but all 50 states are effective, whatever their laws. New York State has a liberal law, but that hasn't ended the bitter fight over legal abortions. And Betty Rollin reports on the New York reaction to today's ruling.
New York's liberal abortion law was passed more than 2 years ago, and more than 400,000 abortions have been successfully performed. Nevertheless, opposition has been bitter and continual. The law was actually repealed last year, but Governor Nelson Rockefeller vetoed the repeal. With yet another attempt at repeal underway, today's decision came as a shock to both anti- and pro-abortionist forces.
Well, it means that January 22nd, 1973 will stand out as one of the great days for freedom and free choice. This allows a woman free choice as whether or not to remain pregnant. This is extraordinary.
For some women, this law will mean the difference between having an abortion or not. For many others, the law will mean simply having the abortion in their own state instead of traveling to another state like New York. This New York clinic, for example, reports that 48% of its patients are from out of the state. The attitude of the Roman Catholic Church in New York was expressed by Terence Cardinal Cook in a statement read by a spokesman.
How many millions of children, prior to their birth, will never live to see the light of day because of the shocking action of the majority of the United States Supreme Court today? Whatever their legal rationale, seven men have made a tragic utilitarian judgment regarding who shall live and who shall die. In spite of this horrifying decision, the American people must rededicate themselves to the protection of the sacredness of all human life.
From the beginning, pro-abortionist forces have seen this issue as a question of freedom of an individual's choice. The freedom to have an abortion is now legal in every state. The basic legal fight is in effect over. But according to the Roman Catholic Church, the moral fight will never end, and the Church will continue to instruct women and institutions not to take advantage of this choice. Betty Rollin, NBC News, New York.
Thanks to Rachel Maddow for digging up that bit of history. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said she plans to bring up Congresswoman Judy Chu's Women's Health Protection Act, which is intended to codify Roe v. Wade. She's introduced this bill for the last six terms. It likely has the votes to pass the House, but then comes the Senate, where the filibuster would keep it from passing. Most Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster. The only thing holding it up appears to be Senators Manchin and Sinema. Pelosi railed against the Supreme Court's, quote, cowardly, dark of night decision to allow the Texas abortion ban to take effect. And already, American Taliban elected officials in Republican-controlled states are talking about enacting similar laws. So it's logical to be freaked out by this. But to try to put a positive spin on it, this move by the high court has horrified a majority of Americans, but it could be the final nail in the coffin of the Republican Party. This move is unpopular. Just a few months ago, in polls from Quinnipiac to Fox News, it was across the board. 62% to 69% of American voters said they wanted the court to uphold the Roe v. Wade precedent. One other interesting observation is the silence from both the politicians, including Texas representatives, and the right-wing media, who've all been pushing, allegedly, to overturn Roe v. Wade for decades. But this earth-shattering decision was barely mentioned on Fox since the surprise ruling came down. A new survey from the Centers for Disease Control finds that more than 80% of Americans 16 and older have some level of immunity against the coronavirus, most of it through vaccination. The results also indicated that about twice as many people have been infected with the virus as have officially been counted. More than 39 million Americans have been diagnosed with coronavirus since the pandemic began last year. With the latest COVID-19 surge turning American life on its end, Dr. Anthony Fauci said the rollout of booster doses could begin within weeks, pending FDA authorization. Meanwhile, three major American medical groups issued a statement asking everyone to please stop taking ivermectin. It's a drug often used for deworming livestock. For some reason, these people are taking it in an attempt to prevent symptoms of COVID-19. And then idiots like Joe Rogan get infected because they won't get vaccinated, yet they'll take this horse dewormer? As the pandemic drags on, ivermectin is the latest unlikely and dangerous fixation for those people who won't listen to science and think they know better than the doctors. Just lovely. Now, as the Gulf Coast and Northeast deal with a massive disaster left in the wake of Hurricane Ida, the West wishes it had some of that water. Firefighters battling California's massive Caldor fire are facing the likelihood of even more fires breaking out in the upcoming weeks. There's a severe drought suffocating most of the American West. It's leading to water shortages and creating the ideal environment for wildfires to spark and spread rapidly. In addition to the blazes, firefighters are facing exhaustion and COVID-19 infections as this extended fire season shows no sign of slowing down. And finally, authorities are already warning about another, quote, rally at the U.S. Capitol. This one, scheduled for September 18th. Far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers are reportedly planning to head back to the U.S. Capitol, this time demanding justice for the hundreds of people charged in connection with the January 6th insurrection. U.S. Capitol police are discussing whether that perimeter fence will need to be put back up. And in a related story, Jacob Chansley, remember him, the man who came to be known as the QAnon shaman? He heads before a judge on Friday, saying he no longer wants to be called the QAnon shaman and no longer wants to be affiliated with the conspiracy group. He's expected to plead guilty, though the terms of the deal are not yet clear, including to which charges he'll plead guilty and what, if any, term of incarceration he might serve. Hey, Q boy. Insurrections have consequences. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully supported by listeners, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.